Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Ken Grossinger has written a compelling new book about the synergy and power possible between art and organizing. His book is Art Works, How Organizers and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. And it brings together many social change efforts of the recent decades and the various forms of art that empower dramatic movement toward change. From the civil rights movement to Black Lives Matter to environmental efforts to a wealth of other actions, looking at a wide spectrum of forms of art and not just music and painting, Ken's book is amazingly deep and wide in its purview. Ken's 35 years of organizing and his eagle eyes give him a valuable vantage point to analyze that made and missed opportunities for artists and organizers to harness their mutual strengths. Remember to check out the bonus excerpts on northernspiritradio.org, portions that didn't fit in the 55-minute broadcast. Thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance today. Ken Grossinger joins us on Zoom from Washington, D.C. Ken, thank you so very, very much for joining me for Spirit in Action.
I'm delighted to be here with you, Mark.
This book, Artworks, is a delightful compendium of so many aspects of the social change movements, the work that's been done over the lifetime that I've been witnessing it. I mean, I was born in 54, so the civil rights movement was certainly going at that time, and it extends back further in time. But when you touch on that, Black Lives Matter and the music of Holly Near and on in this book, it's so rich. It feels like a historical tome in a good way, as well as a conceptual manual for how artists and organizers can work together to make the world better. You've been doing this work for something like 35 years. Is this your end of employment treaties?
It is not. The question is what the next thing is, which may be another book, because the take up for this one has been so strong. The impetus for me writing this book, and maybe I should say a word about briefly what the focus of it is, which is on the impact of collaboration between artists and organizers. So it's not just the power of art that we're talking about. We're talking about what happens when artists and organizers join forces. And that's why the book looks at different social movements, civil rights and Black Lives Matter, environmental and immigrant justice. And it also looks at two institutions, philanthropy and museums, and the extent to which they support or disrupt social change strategies. And I wrote this book because, as you mentioned, I've been in organizing all of my life. And when I was taught how to think about organizing, when I practiced it, and when I started teaching younger activists how to think about their work, art and culture were never a part of the mix. And then I married an artist. And I realized just how big a boat I missed. And I learned something else, that it was not just organizers that didn't think strategically about art and culture, but that it was artists also who didn't think strategically about their work in the service of social movements, but rather focused on it as an individual form of political expression. So the book is really an attempt to bring those two things together.
You know, you start off, I think the first movement you talk about is civil rights movement, which for so many of us is stirring, exciting. It was a crucial change point in the history of this country. But then, of course, you jump right to the Black Lives Matter movement, which, of course, we're aware that we haven't achieved civil rights equality. So We Shall Overcome is a song, and that's one form of art, right? Song that most of us associate with change. As a matter of fact, in 1982, the first year I became a war tax resister, the group of people who were accompanying me from my war tax resistance group locally in Milwaukee, at a certain point, I had to go in and confront them with my tax form and so on. And they were outside and they formed a circle and they said, well, we should sing something. And so they sang, We Shall Overcome. But that wasn't the song of the moment. That was just the one that stands so high in people's imagination. And there are many, many songs, and you pull them out in the book, Artworks. So were you connected in some way with civil rights?
Like you, I was born in 1954, so it was a little before my time. But I have always felt like it's that tradition that I've been walking in.
But you also come out of a religious tradition. You're Jewish. That's where you grew up. And did some of your activism come out of that as well?
Yeah, it's a fascinating look back. When I was growing up, I had the dubious distinction of going to high school, but then having to go to high school again in my synagogue. We had a teacher, his name was Mr. Wiener, and it was a small group of eight people in this class. And the same class, same group of eight, met for 3 years. To speak to the question of Jewish education, of the eight people that were part of this class, five of them became organizers and activists.
Wow, that's a real indication of something powerful.
And I don't exactly feel comfortable sharing their names, but they're names that people would know that work in social movement politics. And so Jewish tradition as well as experience really contributed much to the way that I approach the world.
Do you do art yourself? Is that part of your repertoire, or is this in collaboration with people who think of themselves as artists?
The book is oriented more towards collaboration, but I have been playing guitar just as an amateur since I've been about 14. I used my bar mitzvah money to buy my first guitar. I think it was for $70. It was an old Univox acoustic. But over the years, I continue to play it. So I've always had a natural draw to music.
Music has certainly drawn me. The written kind of art hasn't quite been where I found my strength. Although, you should see those portraits that my grandchildren drew of me on the wall there. It's you'll probably laugh more than be awed, but it makes a difference the way that art shows up in our lives. You also talk a bit about not just songs and murals, etc., but you talk about movies, and then you talk about philanthropy and art working together. So I really see what you said, art writ large. I see you addressing that in so many different areas in the book. It's hard to put it into few words, and I don't think you should be that succinct. So, civil rights movement and Black Lives Matter, you create a connection between them, a hyphen that stretches 50, 60 years.
Yeah, I tried to create a narrative arc between the two. And I started with the civil rights movement very consciously because the book generally focuses on movements of the last 20 years. And the publisher was not keen to do another historical book about this subject, but was very interested in what was going on today. And I felt like I wanted to reach younger people, younger than you and I. But you couldn't write a book about art and politics without talking about the civil rights movement, because in the civil rights movement, it was embedded. And it was embedded in very kind of natural ways. Bernice Reagan Johnson says that song leaders didn't think about themselves as song leaders. We were just organizers that used song for mobilization. Those are not her exact words. Those are my words, but that captures the spirit of what she does. And one of the really interesting things about the civil rights movement related to art is the extent to which SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, integrated art into all of its work. I can share an example drawn from photography. There was a photographer, during the civil rights movement, a lot of white volunteers went south to work as SNCC volunteers. And one of them was this guy named Danny Lyon, who was a photographer. And James Forman, who at that time was the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, realized that if he was going to expose the brutality of white supremacy in the South, he needed incontestable evidence that it existed. Julian Bond said that photography organized was our organizer. And he asked Danny Lyon to find 33 teenage girls who had been swept up at a movie theater for protesting racial segregation. They were locked up for 45 days without being arrested. Their families didn't know where they were. Their communities didn't know where they were. And James Forman said to Danny Lyon, you need to find these girls and photograph them. And along with two civil rights workers, he goes to the Leesburg stockade and finds them in Georgia. And the two civil rights workers distract the guards. And Danny, through broken shards of glass and bars, takes pictures of these girls locked up in the stockade. And he brings the pictures back to Forman. And Forman then shares them with the media. Jet magazine, you may remember, published the photographs. Other news outlets published the photograph. It led to Senator Harrison, who was a senator from Pennsylvania at the time, entering it into congressional record. And that led to Robert F. Kennedy, who at that time was the Attorney General of the United States, to demand that those girls be released. And it was an indicator of how art is not just a reflection or a reaction to social conditions, but a contributor to social change. And so SNCC, you could find that kind of expression in SNCC's work through the Free Southern Theater, through the music, through photography. And then, you know, one of the very first murals that was made of the Black Panther was made by a civil rights worker in SNCC. Her name was Jennifer Lawson. And she painted a picture of a Black Panther on a billboard, which said, register to vote and go on home. Go on home because you're going on home to safety and register to vote. And of course, we know what happened with that Black Panther billboard. It became, I don't know if, you know, there's some debate about whether that was the basis for the Black Panther Party adopting the Panther or not. I believe it was. So SNCC really integrated this into their work. Culture and politics were meshed in a way that hadn't been meshed. Although there are certainly examples of it here and there about where culture has been brought into organizing.
So why was it particularly integrated in the civil rights movement? I have my own theories about that. Part of it coming out of the Black church movement. I mean, Martin Luther King and all those folks, but also the Jewish activists. Music is such a part of Jewish expression. Whether it's a Nigun or any of the other songs, it's such a part of it. I was wondering if that had some influence on the whole civil rights movement.
I just recently heard Jennifer Lawson talk about this question. It's a really good question. Jennifer is part of this thing called the SNCC Legacy Project, which were SNCC workers that are trying to use the lessons of SNCC in current day organizing. And Jennifer said it really was distinctively Southern, that the culture of the South lent itself to cultural expressions. Of course, that was not confined to the South, but I think she thought, and I have a sense, that it was the culture. For instance, as you mentioned earlier, the Black church, the gospel sounds of the Black church really were brought out onto the street by Fannie Lou Hamer and any number of other singer-songwriters that you and I know about.
What about jump forward 60 plus years and let's talk about Black Lives Matter movement and art as part of that? I think by the time we get to Black Lives Matter, religion is somewhat of a dirty word occasionally in the liberal circles, in progressive circles. There's almost a prejudice against it. And part of my take on it is that that's an unhealthy stereotype that just turns it over to the right-wing folks. But did art have roots and feet in running and contribute strongly to Black Lives Matter?
Without question. We could talk about music and murals and monuments. If I can remember all three of those things by the time I get through the first, I'll be good at my age.
M&M&M.
So music, what was so, fascinating is the wrong word. I guess important is the right word. But when you think about the relationship between art and politics, it's also quite fascinating. Music took on a different form in Black Lives Matter. Video projections, music videos were ubiquitous. Literally tens of millions of people saw activists and their music videos. And I think that that had a very sustaining and nurturing impact, not in the same way as when you're on a picket line and you're singing, "Don't Let Anyone Turn You Around." But nevertheless, it encouraged, it supported, and it nourished activists. So music was really, although you didn't see the massive music events like you saw in the 60s, the internet was now mediating a lot of this. What you did see in person, but also projected through the internet, were the power of murals. I mean, the power of George Floyd's mural that led to thousands of other murals being made in countries around the world, from Syria to Palestine to Australia to Western Europe. They became places of grieving. They became places of gathering. And they became places of inspiration, calling for accountability for police killing Black activists. And likewise, you saw some very dramatic kind of shifts, artists attempting to shift the narratives. Let me diverge for a second to talk about narrative, because I think what typically happens is that we know that through lobbying and advocacy and organizing, that sometimes policy and legislative changes to the good can be made. But what happens is when power changes hands, they get rolled back. And so the pendulum swings left to right. And what art does is addresses the narratives underlying these fights. So for instance, Kehinde Wiley has a monument in Virginia at the Museum of Fine Art. It's a picture of a horseman. That's not an unfamiliar image, right? A lot of these white supremacy Confederate generals sat on horseback looking down on people, and you're staring up at a white supremacist as if they were a hero. And what Kehinde Wiley did was pull down the white Confederate general and put there in its stay a Black horseman wearing dreadlocks and sneakers. And so he subverted the image. So now when you're a little child walking by the 16-foot memorial made of bronze and steel and so forth, you're looking up at a different kind of hero. So it's that kind of narrative shift. In and of itself, one example like that isn't going to change anything. But narratives, there needs to be some kind of narrative power. Hank Willis Thomas, the photographer, says change on his timeline is 10, 20, and 30, and 40 years. And that's because he's not talking about legislative or policy changes. He's talking about cultural changes, the way we think about the world, shifting our cultural viewpoints. And so art and the Black Lives Matter, whether it's through that memorial, through the murals, or through the music, really helped move that along.
And you've already mentioned a few other forms in which art and change happen. Museums is one of them. The fact that there's a statue in public really affects how people think. And it's amazing how many people knee-jerk wanted to defend the Confederate statues, even though they stood for something bad, because it's part of your heart, the artwork that's around you.
Yeah, it penetrates popular culture in a way that organizers never will.
Unless you have your way. And that's part of what I want to make the point here. Part of the thrust, and maybe a central part of the thrust of Artworks by Ken Grossinger, it's to talk about collaboration between organizers and artists so that we are working not only in the moment, but in that 20, 30, 40 year lifespan, changing the culture. And I want you to say a little bit more about that, because the idea was so compelling to me when I read it in your book, Ken. Frequently, we think about, okay, we're going to get this bill passed. We're going to get this legislative act. We'll get this person replaced in government, which is a thing of the moment. But then the question is, what's the ground on which we're working? What is the overall mural of our lives that is guiding what's going to happen next year and in 4 years and so on down the road? I think that many people were very excited when Obama was elected. He couldn't have been elected. It was unthinkable to us that our nation would get rid of its racism to the degree that we could elect a Black president in 2008. And yet it was so captivating. Unfortunately, there is a background to our society such that the Tea Party movement of 2010 undermined much of the work that should have been accomplished with the Obama administration. So I think that your book wisely talks about how we paint the entire background we're living into in the future, and not just let's get this one thing done.
Yeah, I want to talk about film for a minute, because it's another art medium that we haven't yet discussed this morning. And the difference between addressing that background and moving things forward. So there's a chapter in the book that focuses on the power of film and political mobilization. And it starts out contrasting two of Jane Fonda's films. One was The China Syndrome. Many listeners will remember Jack Lemmon, Richard Dreyfuss, Michael Douglas, and Jane Fonda. And Jane Fonda and Michael Douglas go into a nuclear power station on the verge of a nuclear meltdown. And the film ostensibly is meant to raise the question about whether or not nuclear power can ever be safe if it's driven by a profit motive and how that thing is compromised. Ted Turner, long before he became married to Jane Fonda, told Jane that that film turned him around on nuclear power. He came out against nuclear power after watching that film. So that film had a way of lifting up consciousness, and it was accelerated quite significantly because 10 days after the film came out, Three Mile Island happened. And so the box office numbers were 9 times what the production costs were. And it really entered into popular culture in a way that other things might not. But what it wasn't is tied to any kind of social movement. It wasn't tied to an anti-nuclear movement. And so it stopped. It left the backdrop as it was, but lifted up people's consciousness about it. Contrast that with the film 9 to 5. So 9 to 5, as you know, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda,
Dolly Parton. We're not forgetting Dolly, no way.
So the anti-war movement was settling down and Jane was looking for her next thing. And women's equity and power was really what she was focused on at the time. And she wanted to do what she does best, which was to use a film to lift up the question of equity at the workplace. And she connected with an organizer. Her name is Karen Nussbaum, who started the organization 9 to 5. So there's a film called 9 to 5 and an organization called 9 to 5. And the organization existed before the film. And the organization was an organization, kind of like a union, and they eventually merged with the Service Employees International Union. They became a union of office workers who were demanding equity. And so Jane calls up Karen and says, I want to learn about this movement because I want to figure out how I can support it. And she meets with Karen, and Karen then takes Jane to several of her meetings around the country with her affiliates. And one of the meetings was in Ohio, which was the home, actually, of 9 to 5 in Cincinnati, Ohio. And in that meeting, towards the end of the night, in some offhanded kind of way, Jane Fonda says to the audience, does anyone here ever have revenge fantasies about their boss? And so all of a sudden, the place lit up, and she began to hear the incredible stories. The one that I'm familiar with is a woman stands up and said, I want to take my boss's bones and grind them up into coffee grounds and serve them to the other bosses on the staff. And so at that moment, she realized that this couldn't be a narrative, a drama about women's rights if she wanted to penetrate, but it needed to be a comedy. And so 9 to 5, the film, was named after 9 to 5, the organization. And here's what happened. And here, and this gets to my point. So it was tied. Jane said, I could always hold in my heart that my movie was tied to a movement. And what 9 to 5, the organization, did was to do a 20-city tour with the film, with Jane and Lily and others, to talk about women's equity. So what happens as a result of that 20-city tour is that 9 to 5, the organization, doubles its number of chapters. So impact in the world of film can be quite significant. It can be, when film is on its own, a consciousness-raising event. But if you're thinking like an organizer thinks and you want to move things forward, then the collaboration between the artists and organizers are what's so essential. And it really gets to the heart of the book, looking at the impact of those collaborations.
There is such an impact that can be life-changing, or it can be a flash in the pan. And unfortunately, I think our society really encourages people to be just in the moment. The big view is abhorred. That's too heady, or maybe it's too demanding. You know, you've got a smartphone that can give you the adrenaline push of the moment, right? It can also connect you to a mass movement and help things like Arab Spring happen, right? Because your phones. So I really feel that for good to happen in the world, we have to be both embedded locally in the moment and invested and connected over the orders of magnitude with the change for the future. And I think that's what you're pointing us towards, Ken, in artworks, how organizers and artists are creating a better world together. And folks, just to keep in mind, Ken Grossinger is here today for Spirit in Action. His website that you'll follow up with this on is artworksbook.com. I've got that link on northernspiritradio.org. This book is rich. So many stories. For those of us who have been activists for decades, we're going to go in this book and we're going to find the movements that inspired us, that informed us, that changed the directions of our lives. For me, I think it's your second chapter, Singing for Our Lives, Music and Anthems for Our Planet. For me, in 1974, when I discovered the music of Holly Near, and it transformed my view of men, women, peace, equality, equity, all of these things. Her music did that to me. She has a connection, by the way, with Jane Fonda. The two of them traveled across the country together doing peace organization work when Vietnam War was still happening. So yes, Singing for Our Lives transformed me in my life just when I'd become an adult.
So three points I want to make. Two of them are not really points, they're quotes that I want to read about the impact of music during the civil rights movement. And then a third point I want to make is about a friend of yours and mine, Cy Khan, and how he thinks about and uses music in the service of social change. So here are the quotes. The first is by a guy named Wyatt T. Walker, who was the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference at the time, talking about We Shall Overcome. And here's what he says. One cannot describe the vitality and emotion this one song evokes across the Southland. I have heard it sung in great mass meetings with 1,000 voices singing as one. I've heard 6 sing it softly behind the bars of the Hinds County Prison in Mississippi. I've heard old women singing it on the way to work in Albany, Georgia. I've heard the students singing it as they were being dragged away to jail. It generates power that is indescribable. And then the second quote I wanted to read, for us, freedom songs were the psychic threads that bound the movement into a tapestry of purpose, solidarity, hope, and courage. The songs spread our message. The songs bonded us together. The songs elevated our courage. The songs shielded us from hate. The songs forged our discipline. The songs protected us from danger. And it was the songs that kept us sane. And I could not add much to those two quotes about the power of music, except to say that the kind of work that Cy Khan and other civil rights organizers, musicians, and singer-songwriters and authors, Cy wears a lot of different hats, as you know, did and continues to do today was much like the difference between, it's probably a poor analogy, but between China Syndrome and a 9 to 5, where one was focused on the power of the film itself and one was focused on movement organizing. Cy went up to Alaska to help with the fight in Bristol Bay. There was a mine that the extractive industries were trying to create called Pebble Mine. And it would have been the largest open pit mine in the country and one of the two largest in the world. And it was being built in close proximity to where there was a 1906 earthquake. I think that's the date. And that earthquake caused all kinds of tsunamis, led to 138 deaths. And it just wreaked havoc on the land and the culture that was surrounding it. And so this is where the extractive industries wanted to build. And the fishing industry, which is the two most powerful industries were the extractive mining industries and the fishing industries. And a lot of the fishermen organized, both fishermen that fished for sustenance, fishermen that fished for sport, and fishermen that fished for commercial purposes. They all got together and several of them happened to be musicians. And they realized that what their campaign lacked was an anthem, that they had no theme song around which to organize people. And they persuaded Cy to come up from North Carolina to Bristol Bay to write them a theme song. And it wasn't just Psy going up there and observing what was going on, but they did a lot of really interesting things. So they brought Psy into a third grade class. And Psy said to the kids, however you talk to kids that are in the third grade, he says, "What would you want my music to say about Pebble Mine?" And the class was known as Rebels to the Pebble. And so he wrote a song based upon what they said. He said, "I'll be your musical messenger if you give me the message." And he wrote this powerful song called Abundance, which was put on an album that he and other musicians created. But the local fishermen did a whole lot more than that. So they brought Psy into the homes of people in Bristol Bay, and they would have small meetings, 15 or 20 meetings, and Psy would create these new songs, and he would play them for people in the homes. And he would say, "Okay, what did you like about these songs? What don't you like? And what do you think I should do with them?" And it was that process that helped build trust between songwriters and the fishermen that were fighting the fight. And the fishermen ultimately said to Psy, "Listen, we've got Alaska covered, but we don't have anyone in the lower 48 that's singing about our work." And so Psy started something called the Musicians United to protect Bristol Bay and started raising money from the lower 48 and through his albums and CDs. And so what we often forget is that artists need to be at the strategy tables. You don't bring them in when the strategy is already baked. You bring them in at the front end. And only through that type of genuine, authentic collaboration are the possibilities strong. And so, you know, musicians have contact lists. Celebrity musicians have millions and millions of followers. They've got fundraising lists. They are organizers, much like Bernice Reagan Johnson was in the 1960s. But we don't often think about musicians in that way. We think about them as someone that should come to open a show or close it, but not really a part of the development of a campaign. And so that's what Psy's work has taught us.
Well, he knows because he lives at that nexus, being both an organizer and an artist for so many decades. And again, folks, Psy Khan, if you don't know him, where you been hiding? I mean, he's been doing such great organizing and music for decades. And the bit that Ken Grossinger just told us about the foundation of the Musicians United to Protect Bristol Bay, I've interviewed him about that, whatever it was, 10 years ago. You can just search his name on my website and find the 6-7 times. And I'm going to be interviewing him more because he turns 80 in April.
April 23rd.
Yes, day after Earth Day. So we go first, the Earth was created, and then Psy Khan. And he's been doing such great work, and he's the one who pointed me in the direction of Ken Grossinger here today for Spirit in Action. Again, my website is northernspiritradio.org. On the site, you'll find these links to my past interviews with Psy and so many other world-changing people, including a couple of the Native musicians and legislators in Alaska who've been working for Bristol Bay and in so many other ways, civil rights activists and so many other artists who are changing the world. Come to the site, listen to those programs, comment on them when you get there, and let us hear your voice too, because just as Ken was saying, I don't need to bring you in afterwards. You're part of what helps create Spirit in Action. So please communicate. I also need your support. You can donate via my site. And just keep in mind that we're also carried on something like 35 community radio stations nationwide in the U.S. And so we're getting the word out that way as well as online with podcasts. You can access us either way, but I really think that those community radio stations are so vital in terms of nurturing true culture and change in this country. So support them with your hands, with your wallet, in your community. And if they're not carrying Spirit in Action or my Song of the Soul program, please get them to carry it, because we want this word to go out and travel as widely. It's a circle of communication and connection. And I want to serve the communities, which is why I also do not accept money from government or from corporations. It always comes with strings attached. I want you, the listeners, to be supporting Northern Spirit Radio. Ken Grossinger's just released book is Artworks, How Organizers and artists are creating a better world together. Ken Grossinger, and his website is artworksbook.com. Again, NordenspiritRadio.org. I have the link to Ken and his activism, Amanda Sycon, and everybody else that I've spoken to over these past 18 and a half years who've been doing this show. So I've wandered a bit afield, Ken, but there's so much of what you say which just demands more commentary and input. And of course, you do that in the book. I wanted to talk a little bit about films here. You talk about Chasing Ice and how transformative that documentary was. You mention in passing An Inconvenient Truth and how that got so many people very concerned about climate change. One thing I found was interesting is I don't know if I actually heard mention of any of Michael Moore's documentaries, Bowling for Columbine and so on, which was a great intersection of activism and art. Could you say a little bit about the role of those kind of films? You talked about Jane Fonda's cases.
Yeah, I talked about Jane's because they're narrative films, and what organizers often think about are documentary films. And so I wanted to bring in another look at this. But in terms of the docs like Inconvenient Truth and Chasing Ice, they were so important because they were used and they demonstrated the power of film in different kinds of contexts. So in the case of Chasing Ice, Jeff Orlovsky, the filmmaker, organized another story that takes place in Ohio, organized around Representative Tabiri, who is a climate denier. I forget which district in Ohio he represented. And what Jeff did was to do 90 screenings of this film, Chasing Ice, which was a powerful story about the impact of climate change on the earth. And he hired a guy named Mark Melman, who's a national pollster, not necessarily my favorite national pollster, but nevertheless, a national pollster, I think, to do a before and after study. And what he found is that people's views about climate change, about how imminent it was, about who causes it, the whole range of issues that we're all familiar with, it moved the needle anywhere from 15 to 25% in the direction of, wow, climate change is real, and we really need to do something about it. So it was kind of a hands-on way that Jeff used it for community organizing. And he built an alliance of organizations who sponsored the film. And likewise, but differently, The Inconvenient Truth led to the training of hundreds of activists who worked on climate change. And so both of these films in their different ways contributed to the organizing around it.
You have, it's only, what, 6 or 8 pages in the book where you have pictures, drawings, images that you've captured. There's one of them that for me was absolutely striking, hitting right at the center of my heart. It's the picture of a child overlooking the border wall. Could you talk about that? Because immigration is one of the places where organizing and art have intersected so strongly.
Yeah, it's a shame that we can't project an image onto a radio program, because nothing I can say can describe the power of that one image, but I will do my best to describe it. It was created by a French photographer and muralist named J.R. And so it was created in the height of the Trump administration, when the family separation policies were first being advanced and Trump was demonizing Mexicans in all kinds of vile ways. And what JR did was to go to the town of Tecate, which is a border town, went into the Tecate community, which is a very, very, very small community, and met with the people who live there. And in one of the homes, there was this baby. The baby's name was Kikito. And the baby was 1 year old and in its crib. And JR asked the mother if he could take a picture of baby Kikito. And the mother said, sure. So he took a picture of Kikito in his crib. And then JR had another idea. And he says to the mother, would you mind if I blew up your son and put him on a mural? And so the mother was very pleased. She thought it was a real connection. Long and short, she said yes. And what JR did was to blow up baby Kikito to 70 feet, propped up by scaffolding and plywood. And it's an image of baby Kikito, which was actually looking out over its crib. But along the bottom, he put the border wall with two ICE agents on the other side. So you've got baby Kikito looking out over the U.S.-Mexico border, out onto two ICE agents. The image is in there because it's meant to talk about narrative change that we were talking about earlier and how you swap the narratives. So you've got two things happening. JR posts that image on his Instagram account, and a million people or so see it within the first 24 hours. It becomes a media sensation. And all of a sudden, people from around the world start going down to Tecate to look at baby Kikito. So it generates a lot of media. And now what you're doing is you're comparing Trump's vile description of Mexicans with a humanitarian image that you're looking up at. And so on the one hand, you have Trump talking about Mexicans in very vile terms and instituting family separation policies and basically demonizing them in the same way that Trump is demonizing people now in his campaign for president in 2024. So you've got the demonization of Mexicans by Trump during his administration offset against this humanitarian image of baby Kikito. And so what artists want to do and try to do is to create narrative power. One image after the other, after another form of artistic and political expression to flip the narrative on its head.
One of the things that happened along the way that I just wished my voice was strong enough. Of course, we've got an issue on the left. A lot of us value ourselves as individualists, nonconformists. So we're not going to march in line to the orders from above. We're not going to do that, even if it's good orders from above. And one of the strengths of some of the conservatives and Republicans has been that they come up with a talking point and then they send it out everywhere and everyone marches in step to that. And they say death chambers, or they say caravans coming from the South. And you know what I really wish we could have done is if so many liberals had been willing to, we could have changed that word caravan and turn it into pilgrimage. And who's going to speak against a pilgrimage? And just that one word substitution, and all of a sudden the images in people's head change tremendously. It's Kikito, it's people walking on the path along with Jesus, it's pilgrimage would have been such a transformative narrative. And language is so important, but again, our individualism. I actually saw a political strategist for the Democratic Party talking about how it's important to get out the talking points and share them widely and thereby transform. And he said, you know, the Republicans do this very effectively. And he said the Democrats also do this. But everybody individually says, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't, because we're marching to our own drummer. So there's major issues when you talk about collaboration between those who want to march to their own drum, saying, I am an island by myself, which is sometimes a liberal point of view, sometimes it's a conservative point of view. Do you encounter that in terms of how art works?
Yeah. The last chapter of the book, the afterword, is a discussion that takes place between organizers and artists about the issues associated with collaboration. And they're very real. On the one hand, you have I mentioned Hank Willis Thomas earlier saying that timeline in my world is 10, 20, 30, and 40 years. Whereas organizers, the timeline for organizers is yesterday. We want it done yesterday. We want it done today. We want it done tomorrow. So they approach things in a different kind of way, even though artists feel the same urgency that we feel. So one thing is the timeline. A second is message control. So if you're an organization like the League of Conservation Voters, you're investing tens of thousands of dollars into polling for messaging purposes. And you want your staff and you want your audience and your members to frame things along those message principles, kind of like what you were talking about in those memos, because framing is really powerful. And the Republicans, as you said, have done that really, really well. And artists don't want to be pigeonholed into a message that's been created and told. They want the flexibility to address the issue in the way that speaks to them and speaks to their audience. And so that can cause a big issue between organizers and artists, because artists don't want to be hemmed in and organizers don't want to give up tens of thousands of dollars worth of polling to say, well, we need to talk about it like this. And those issues, the timeline, message control, and there are others like funding and the difference between applying for art funding and organizing funding, those can only be reconciled when there is an agreement up front between artists and organizers in terms of how they're going to approach their work and what the scope of their work was. Or labor organizers think about this as memorandum of understanding. But of course, that's much too formal a way to describe in the nonprofit world. But that's what I think we need. We need artists to understand what they can expect from the organizers and the organizers to understand what they can expect from the artists. And when that happens, you've got a magic.
Let's just say a few more things about you, Ken, because you've got something like 35 years of experience in movements for social economic justice. You've been active with unions, community organizations, and you're also director of Impact Philanthropy and Democracy Partners. What is that?
So Democracy Partners is a consulting firm, whether you like consulting firms or not, it is one. And this particular work that I do is with foundations and some individual donors in terms of figuring out how to maximize their contribution for social impact.
And there is a whole chapter related to foundations and funders and how they can work together, how they can be collaborative and make changes that way. You also co-executive produced some Netflix documentaries, The Social Dilemma, The Bleeding Edge. Which ones are you most proud of? Which do you think had the most effect?
I'm proud of all of them. They all had great effect.
Which of your children do you choose?
That question.
But do say a few words about these documentaries.
Bleeding Edge, a film by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, I think 2018, but I could be getting that wrong, is a film about the medical device industry. It's a powerful film that looks at five different medical devices and the adverse impact that they've had because of the lack of regulation around medical devices. And I'll share a story. This is a story of an orthopedic surgeon that did hip replacements. There are five. I've learned, and hopefully I'll never know about, but I've learned about, there are five different types of hip replacements. And one of them is metal on metal. You know, metal ball fits into a metal socket. And he's a very eminent physician, and he travels the country speaking, and he's in Oregon giving a talk. And when he goes back to his hotel room, he has a psychotic break. And so the hotel calls his wife comes out and gets him. And after a week or two, he comes back to reality. And he says to himself, well, I'm a doctor, I should be able to figure out what happened to me. And it turns out that the metal on metal hip replacement leached 100 times more cobalt than the body could absorb, and that's what generated his psychotic break. And it's because of the way that the regulatory mechanisms exist and how they define medical devices and what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do that enabled something like that to happen. So that film had a very powerful impact. In one case, it forced a international corporation, whose name I don't want to mention because I...
You don't want to get sued.
Okay. Exactly. Thank you. To pull their product off the market. They kept it in the international market, but they pulled it off the U.S. market. And so films like that can have enormous impact. The Social Dilemma was a film about the perils associated with the current internet age. It's told through the voice of the major players who created Google and Amazon and Facebook. And so these are very powerful sources of information who are raising the red flag. And there's a whole impact campaign that is being organized around it. And so we just enjoy working with these filmmakers on the organizing side and on the creative side. I mean my wife, she's an artist, as I mentioned at the front end. She brings an aesthetic eye to this while I bring a strategic eye to this, and we're a dynamic couple.
So you're doing exactly what Art Moves is talking about. Organizers and artists creating a better world together. You've just done this experimentation in your family.
Funny thing about that, huh?
Which words in the book did you change because your wife said, hey, that's not respectful of artists?
She read every word in this book at least 3 times, and her name ought to be on it because she was such an important contributor to it. The book is dedicated to her. I should say, you may want to incorporate it somewhere. I'm not sure what the segue would be, but I should say a word about museums. I want to tell another story about the Speed Museum in the context of Black Lives Matter, because museums need to be as much about today and tomorrow as they are about yesterday. And so when Breonna Taylor was killed in Louisville, Kentucky, and Stephen Riley, the head of the Speed Museum, which is the largest and oldest cultural institution in Kentucky, asked himself what it meant to be a director in the times of Black Lives Matter when George Floyd killer was on trial and Breonna Taylor had just been killed in his hometown. And what he decided to do was to empty several of his galleries in order to do an exhibition about Breonna and Black Lives Matter. The centerpiece of the exhibition was a portrait of Breonna Taylor made by Amy Sherald, who did the Michelle Obama portrait that's in the National Portrait Gallery. Ta-Nehisi Coates commissioned Amy Sherald to do this portrait. And Amy said she would do it, but she wanted it shown in Louisville. And so it became the centerpiece of this. What Riley did was, instead of hiring a curator to put it together, he created two advisory boards. One was a national advisory board made up of artists whose family members have been killed or maimed by police. And the other was the community advisory board, which was made up of mental health workers, legal advocates, organizers, economic development folks. And the two boards would not always see eye to eye on everything. So the national board, for instance, said, well, we should have 30 pieces about Black Lives Matter. And the local board said, yeah, but they have to all be done by Black artists. And so they have this conversation back and forth on any one of a number of different issues. What's important is that what Stephen Riley did was to bring in the community by bringing in these advisory boards. They, along with Tamika Palmer, Breonna Taylor's mother, informed the content of the show that the curator wound up putting together, such that Sadiqa Reynolds, who at that time was the CEO of the Louisville Urban League, said, it was the first time my people ever felt comfortable walking into the museum.
Oh, wow.
They really shifted the way museums operate, and it's become a model in my mind for what we need to do when we talk about the historic problems of race, gender, identity, and class within museums, which have for so long just shown white male artists and gave rise to that feeling of not being included or invited in. It's an important lesson for artists and museum workers to learn about how they can become impactful. And it's an important framing because museums can become community action targets or they can become community building institutions. And that was a good example of one that became a community building institution.
There are these stories, these experiences, and so much more included in Ken Grossinger's book, Artworks, How Organizers and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. Again, the website you want to go to is artworksbook.com. The link's on NordenSpiritRadio.org. Ken, this is such a rich book. The fruits of your 35 years of labor, organizing, connecting, and healing this world, I think, are so evident in it. I can't wait to see the sequel, and I hope to have you back for that.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you for all the good work you do. You were talking about kind of the right-wing echo chamber, or you were talking about actually our side of the echo chamber. But the point is so important to make because the right wing has really captured that. And it's through programs like yours and the 35 affiliates and others that are providing a balance, a counterbalance to that. And that's one of the reasons why I think what you're doing is so important. And I want to thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you, Ken, and thanks for joining me for Spirit in Action. And folks, come back next week. We'll have more good world healing workers here for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find Deep Roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.